Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. We've got a bunch of folks in the studio today.
Mike and many others.
And Bill Timmerman.
Hey.
And Gary LeMaster.
Good morning.
Now, we announced last week that Eric Wright was going to come in and talk about his book, Envisioning Real Utopias. Interesting title, contradictory title. A family emergency came up, and he's not able to be with us. So we thought we'd continue our discussion with Bill Timmerman, and we've added in Gary about the defense budget, defense spending, and the issues that it and the implications of it. So, Bill, set the stage a little bit. How much money do we spend? How does the American defense budget compare with other countries?
You want to hear the truth, or do you? No, the truth is nobody knows. Not even the Defense Department knows. There's so much money squirreled away in so many different places. There are so many different appropriations from Congress. And there are so many black programs, for example, and there are so many questions about whether this is an item of defense spending or not that we don't really know. But most estimates of the spending in the, well, not the current fiscal year, but the last fiscal year for which we have complete figures, which was 2012, the nominal defense budget was $711 billion. That's almost 5% of our gross domestic product. That doesn't include funding for nuclear weapons research and maintenance, veterans affairs, homeland security, interest on the debt for past wars, and a number of other things.
And it's amazing how you can not include veterans in military spending.
Yeah, well,
it's
not part of military spending.
If you include all of that, the estimates are that the actual defense spending in 2012 was somewhere between $1 trillion and $1.4 trillion, which when you consider that, that the United States gross domestic product is estimated at somewhere between $15 and $17 trillion, that's serious money by anybody's measurement.
Well, especially by comparison. Yeah. You got the comparison figures there.
The Government Accounting Office released a report, and what it said was that there are significant management problems with the defense budget, that they were actually unable to audit what it actually is. They can't figure it out.
That's my prayer on my taxes. I'm hoping it's just so screwed up I'll never be able to be audited.
Yeah. Well, that's partly by design. If the people can't complain about things they don't know about.
And so the defense budget doesn't include a lot of things, folks, that you assume probably it does include. For instance, Veterans Affairs that Bill mentioned. It doesn't include any of the over in connection and with the FBI, the CIA, and NASA, all of which have a military dimension. In fact, the CIA's military dimension has been accelerating very rapidly, and people haven't been paying much attention to it. All right, Bill, what else? So that we have this huge defense spending. Let me read one more quote, which I liked, because it comes from the Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of Defense at Gates, and he said, think about this, Bill. Tell me what you think about this. Our Navy is bigger than the next 13 navies combined. And then he said, 11 of the 13 navies are allies of our country. And what kind of sense does this make?
Well, it makes sense only if you see the world in military terms, actually. This is true not just of our Navy, but of our entire military. Of the total world budget for military expenditures, ours alone represents 41% of the total.
So there are, 171, Gary? Do you know the number of countries in the UN? And we count for 41% of the military budget. And the other thing that I thought was interesting when I was thinking about this, Bill, was that the percentage that we're spending on military spending, you'd think the largest economy in the biggest country with the economy of scale would be spending less percentage of its GDP than a small country. Well, somewhere
I think the reason that isn't true is something I mentioned last week, which is the United States, because while it's a large country in terms of its population, there are only about 310 million people in the United States. And we don't like having very large armies because we don't want all of our friends and buddies in uniform. We want them to come work at our gas station or whatever. We have much smaller armies than countries that are potential adversaries that have really large populations like China or Russia. So we tend to rely on technology or the technology of our armaments to overcome the difference. Plus, we have global commitments. The United States thinks it should control the entire world, so we have a Pacific Fleet and an Atlantic Fleet, and we have an Africa Command, and we have, you know, an Arctic Command, and we have a Space Command. But it's basically because we rely on technology, and technology is incredibly expensive when you're not mass-producing the results.
I think one thing you talked about last week was the military's always sees people as adversaries. And when we look at China and Russia, I mean, what do you think? How likely is it that we would get in a war with either one of these countries? We have good relations, testy relations with both.
Well, the reason for that is because of communism and the Cold War after World War II. They were adversaries. There was no doubt about it then. Whether or not they had to be military adversaries is a question. I mean, whose fault is it that we wound up fighting proxy wars in places like Korea? We tend, of course, to assign all the blame to the communist countries, but if you look more carefully at history, it's not at all that clear that the United States was not engaged in no provocations at all. We definitely wanted to keep those people from having any influence outside their own borders.
And what about Vietnam, where the Vietnamese revolutionaries took over the North, the French established a rump regime in the South that never had a lot of support, and then we doubled down on it and invested tremendous number of lives and material trying to destroy one of the milder communist regimes. Not when it started, but it had gotten mild. And now we're investing in the country. Gary?
A lot of these issues, if I may, go back to generations. You know, a lot of our problems in Asia go back to the Opium Wars, where the United States participated along with the West in forcing their way into Asia in order to in the name of trade. And when I was in China in 97, for example, they were turning over, the British were turning Hong Kong back over to the Chinese. Hong Kong, which the British demanded that the Chinese give them. And the main movie playing throughout the country, it was in every little village and every city, every theater, was the Opium Wars. And it was really the true story of how the West forced their way in order to get trade and trying to get, the populace addicted to opium.
Yeah, the European powers are the biggest drug dealers in the world at that period of time, and they enlisted China to grow the opium, which they then sold outside of China. And the Chinese haven't forgotten that. No. I mean, part of the problem here is that after World War II, we were, the leading power in the world, and we did have certain responsibilities, as we talked about last week. But what has happened is that this constant reliance on the military over the years, which may have made some sense right after the war, but makes very little sense now. It's become almost a religion. The military budget is untouchable. It keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And what happens, I think, is that when the world changes, as it has, it's now, as everybody is fond of saying, a multipolar world. There's more than one power, certainly more than one economic power. There's still only one military power. But the problem is when the only tool you have is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail.
Right.
So what do? You don't sit down and negotiate honestly with people who have different interests from you, and Iran is a good example of this. You threaten them. You move aircraft carriers off their borders. You tell them no option is off the table. And you put people inside their borders to try and organize rebellious factions within their countries. These are all, by any historical definition, acts of war. And do we really need to do this? And what will the consequences be? We could review some of the nasty things that have happened.
But Iran is an example of blowback, folks, because back in the 1950s, now I could dates on the tip of my tongue, but maybe not, I won't use it, but back in the 1950s, the United States and Britain overthrew a nationalist who really had the support of the Iranian people, and he was nationalizing oil. And so we overthrew him, and the blowback from that goes down decade after decade after decade. It is now, 60 years since we did that, and they haven't forgotten. And it sets up, in the same way Bill's mentioning, and Gary mentioned the opium wars. People don't forget this kind of stuff. It's a very complex problem, right? We're able to make friends with some former ally opponents, but not others.
Well, here in the United States of amnesia, we do forget. We don't always have a clear picture of our place in the rest of the world.
United States of amnesia.
Well, that's Gorvidal called it. USA stands for United States of Amnesia. We forget yesterday's news immediately. But one of the things that you mentioned before was that any time any entity gets beyond criticism, and if to sit here even this morning and criticize the military in any way. Is a dangerous thing to do, but when something gets beyond criticism, then it gets out of control, and I think that's kind of what's happened with American militarism, which is our topic.
Well, we should point out that the American military itself is of two minds about all of this. The militarists are not really in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The militarists are in the politicians who are so, convinced that as the number one military power in the world, we ought to use that power. I mean, there's a famous quote from Madeleine Albright when they were dealing with the Balkan crisis. Remember when the Serbians were putting Muslims in Bosnia in concentration camps? Madeleine Albright said to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, "What's the point of having this wonderful, undefeatable military if we don't have a chance to use it?"
Yeah,
that was the point of the plan for a new American century which later became the project for a new American century that was put together by Cheney and the neocons. That the key portion of that plan, which they started to implement during the George W. Bush administration, was to use our unparalleled military power to force our economic will on the rest of the world. That was the key element to the whole plan.
Yeah, well, of course, things have now metastasized. They've gotten completely out of control. The military is the first thing you call. What's the quote? The first thing the president wants to know when he wakes up at midnight is, where are our aircraft carriers? Now, I'm sorry, but I don't think that's the first foreign policy thought that should come into the head of a civilian official concerned about future relations with the rest of the world.
And then Kagan and some of the other neoconservatives are saying, we can't cut military spending in 2013. It's the wrong time. If we cut our military spending, everyone will start doubting us and we'll lose power in the world. So he's saying it's directly a result. Our power in the world is not the influence of our democracy, but our military.
Is there a tacit disapproval in negotiating with North Korea right now? Do you get this through the media and certainly through the Republicans that somehow, killing a million Koreans by going to war with them is somehow a bad thing, that negotiating with North Korea, even talking to North Korea, is a bad thing? And I don't get this. Since when did diplomacy become weakness?
Well, the idea of diplomacy when you rely heavily on the military is you say the conditions for negotiating with you are as follows, and you list a number of conditions which no one in their right mind in the country that you plan to negotiate with could accept at the outset. And so, you know, I mean, Hillary Clinton is famous for saying what so-and-so has to understand is the United States X, Y, Z. Well, you know, my question is, if you're sitting on the other side of the table, you've already been told that you can't begin negotiations until you first have surrendered all of your position points.
Right.
What's the point of negotiating?
Right. Exactly.
Our diplomacy tends to be more about threats than about anything else. And I was reminded of that last week. Jimmy Carter was on a television show talking about North Korea and mentioned that during the later years of the Clinton administration, he went to North Korea and worked out a deal with the North Koreans to have them stop any movement towards nuclear arms and exchange for food. And the administration, both countries signed it. And when Bush got into office, they took the agreement and tore it up.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the issue. We're all now concerned about the issue of nuclear proliferation with Iran and North Korea. We don't mind that in the Middle East, Israel has nuclear weapons, but for some reason, we don't think Iran should have any. And, you know, what people don't think about is, for example, in terms of your foreign policy strategy, I mean, it probably hasn't escaped notice in both North Korea and Iran that the countries that we don't attack are the countries who do have nuclear weapons.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, we are constantly threatening both the North Koreans and Iranians with replacing their regimes. Regime change is a phrase that you hear all the time. We'll get rid of your government by military force if you don't do what we want. Well, you know, what is your first thought? Well, if we can manage somehow, if we have the technology, if we can manage somehow to make nuclear weapons, then it's probably in our interest to do so. You know, I mean, otherwise we get treated, instead of getting treated like China gets treated, we get treated like Grenada gets treated.
Or like Libya got treated. I mean, they got Gaddafi to give up his nuclear arms program, and then I think that when I look at this, though, is not to knock the United States too much. This awful power politics goes all the way back through human history. Ancient Greeks do it. Machiavelli spells out exactly how you do this stuff. And what I think is a shame is that here in American democracy, we haven't moved above that. We haven't added additional things to this vicious power game that's kind of characterized state-to-state interactions in the world.
Well, the other thing is we tend to turn everything into warfare. I mean, I remember reading my first articles about cyber warfare back in the early 90s when the only problem on the internet was teenage hackers.
Right.
And the Pentagon was already planning to conduct warfare on the internet. This was like 1993, 1994, about the time when the World Wide Web was getting started. And so now we flash forward to 2010, and suddenly a virus erupts worldwide, a very nasty, very complex, very carefully programmed virus called Stuxnet. And it infects power control systems all over the world. It's shutting down the cooling systems in nuclear plants. It's screwing up the control of electric transmission networks and shutting down power plants. And lo and behold, what do we find out? That the Defense Department, in connection with the Israelis, created this virus to interfere with the control systems on Iranian centrifuges that were refining uranium. Now, centrifuges, because they rotate at very high speeds, are very delicate, and if you change the RPM on them, they tend to disintegrate because they're spinning at such high speed. And we thought, boy, this is really great. We've destroyed the Iranian nuclear enrichment process, and we haven't even had to set foot in the country. Meanwhile, this control software that the Iranians used was manufactured by Siemens, a German company, which writes the control software for all kinds of things all over the world. Well, this Stuxnet virus got out into the wild, and it started attacking power control systems all over the world, including in the United States. Now, we can't prove that the Defense Department created this virus, but most people who know how the Internet they know the Internet architecture well and have traced it as far as they can trace it are pretty clear that that's exactly who's done it. So, you know, basically here the Pentagon has shot itself in the foot, but it gets away with it because nobody can prove that they actually did it. And this is an example of what happens when you think of everything in military terms. You don't sit down and talk to the Iranians about nuclear enrichment for peaceful versus weapons purposes, and you don't negotiate with them so that you can get inspectors into their nuclear plants. You just decide you can't trust them, and from now on it's war.
So what's wrong with militarism? I mean, it's a great jobs program. I mean,
it stimulates the economy. In fact, we're addicted to it, aren't we?
That's right, like foreign oil.
I mean, the Secretary of Defense can say, well, we really don't need all this stuff. And the Army can say, well, we don't need all this stuff.
And yet we
just keep producing more and more, spending more and more of
Well, at this point, defense manufacturing is about the only sophisticated manufacturing that's still left in the United States. And, you know, the Pentagon was and the administrations, previous administrations, were very smart about putting a defense plan in every congressional district. As a consequence of which, the defense budget was always sacrosanct. Well, the problem is, what if you don't need a $711 billion defense budget? How in the world can you cut it when the only factory in this congressman's district is a defense plant?
Well, that there's other uses for the money, that there are, you know, there's limited resources, and there's, you know, lots of people suffering. And for lack of health care, for many other education, all those other programs that we like to see.
It's hard
carries
to cut
forward
something that you've got for something that might be.
A couple of points I'd like to make is that more and more of our defense contracting is going offshore. We're buying a lot of weapon systems from other countries now, and parts of them are made all over the world, which is eventually going to be a difficulty for our military. If somebody decides to abuse that. The other thing is that you can't cut the military, as you were talking about, without seriously damaging the economy. And in 1991, I'm very familiar with after the first Iraq War. You know, George H.W. Bush made huge military cuts. Because the Cold War was over and the Iraq War was over, and so it was an opportunity to draw down the military,
the peace dividend, right?
And close a lot of bases. That single event caused a huge recession that my ad agency suffered through and was terribly crippled by.
And George Bush didn't get reelected.
Right.
The other thing is that I heard someone say, and I think it's exactly spot on, is that the conservatives don't believe in stimulus expending except when it comes to the military. And then they see exactly how it works. Suddenly it occurs to them, this is how it works.
F-35s in Arizona.
Yeah.
Well, this is the moral equivalent of digging holes, paying people to dig holes in the ground and then paying another group of people to fill them up again. I mean, the F-35 is about as useless as a hole in the ground, as it turns out. And, it would be nice if we could make things that we could actually use, or that most of us could actually use instead of a few jet jockeys.
One of the things I was shocked at when I went to my squadron reunion, sounds terribly British, down at Luke Air Force Base.
Squadron reunion.
My squadron reunion in 2010. That's right. We didn't sip tea, but
no China service.
Yeah. But we did have an incredible amount of civilians. The difference between my 1970s service, when everybody was in uniform, except for a couple of consultants, and my 2010 reunion, when the main activity was a golf tournament, and civilians everywhere. There was less than 50% military at the reunion. It was all civil. So that's what had happened.
So even when we talk about the military, the number of people in the military, that disguises the fact of the number of people
on base doing the job. In other words,
well, the good news is there's no more KP, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right.
One of the fascinating things to me is I've got a friend who's still in the National Guard, and we're still firing up in National Guard training. We're still firing off ordnance from World War II.
Oh, yeah, still
once we make this stuff, we make it in abundance, and it never goes away.
And there are also sea rations still floating around, folks. I mean, not everybody gets the MREs.
Eggs are still floating around from back then. Oh, eggs and cheese. I'm serious.
But we have... Democrats of the Red Rocks are going to have meetings, and they support us here. So tell us, Steve, when's their next gig?
Oh, this coming Wednesday. It's coming Thursday, April 18th. We're going to have a professor from University of Arizona, John Pat Willerton. He's going to be talking about Putin's Russia. Willerton's a real expert. He speaks Russian. He's been there many, many times, leads kind of educational tours there, visits them, talk to people. He's an expert on Russian elites, how the Russian government, how the Russian society is organized. It's really interesting. I recommend it. Then next Monday, he's going to be on Democratic Perspective with us.
Yeah, another foreign policy show next. Yeah, we seem to like foreign policy, and our listeners seem to like foreign policy. So,
and I think that you'll find, folks, that in detail it's even more interesting than this kind of generalizations about Russia that we hear when you actually hear how the thing is structured, the good and the bad. And he's an independent thinker, so he's going to be on the show next Monday.
Well, it'll help us have an adult ideas of Russia rather than the childhood ones, I think, that many of us still hold, that are, you know, the whole Soviet era.
So few of us actually get to Russia to actually meet Russians and spend time or actually talk to their political figures. I think what Bill was saying earlier is that when you don't have connections, it tends to breed fantasies and stuff.
Right.
So those are the two main things that we have upcoming. And we hope you folks will listen in next week. We are going to have Eric Wright come and talk about utopias. We need to start thinking beyond the box. And I think talking about utopias and their impact is one way we can do it.
Well, I think it's going to be fun. It's always fun.
Well, a lot of Americans, everybody from the Tea Party to Occupy Wall Street, is really fed up with our existing political system and with both political parties. And it doesn't matter whether you're on the left or on the right.
Everybody
looks at that dysfunctional Congress and says, hey, wait, there's got to be a better way.
Right. But no one sees an alternative. I mean, socialism sort of collapsed worldwide. And so what is the alternative to what we're doing now? We can improve. We can see a narrow route to improve things, but better Social Security. But can we see a route to have a society that's more fulfilling for everybody involved?
Well, listen, I want to talk about real socialism, you know, as it exists in the world and as it could exist in a utopian society. And Eric Olin Wright is an expert at that.
Yeah, he's an actual socialist. We promised socialists.
That's right. Died in the wool, real live socialist. He's got a card or something.
It doesn't quite mean what you folks have been taught that it means. VVID.org. All our podcasts are on there. Take a look at Bill's show last week. Lots and lots of information. Go to the website. You've got Gary's breakdown of what we covered on that show. And we covered it in a great deal of detail.
I just like to wish everyone a happy tax day, as long as we're talking about military.
I just wrote my $1,100 check. Thank you. And which corporation isn't paying taxes? Did Bill Moyer say last night?
I don't know. Most of them.
Most of them. Yeah.
It's my birthday. My dad said to me, "I can always remember your birthday because it's April 15th.
Deduction day.
I have to do my taxes.
Happy birthday. Have a nice day anyway.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, VBID.
Check in with us. Yeah. Go
ahead. VBID.org is where you find this podcast and all the others. And we'll ask Tom about how Graffiti Gold went last night.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.